Dworkin, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. This case is A-20-0686, Vicki Collette Sandberg versus Mark Allen Sandberg.
There, I just unmuted myself. So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I think you probably have had Zoom arguments already, is that right? So you know that this is being recorded and you should say your name at the beginning of your argument. You'll each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Schiff. And Mr. Schiff, are you ready?
I am, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The parties in this case, and the reason why we're here, is they agreed to divide their marital property and marital assets and marital debts equally. Opposing counsel read the agreement into the record. They had a FENE, which is a financial early neutral evaluation with Tom Tuft, and then they had a moderated settlement conference with him as well. They read the record. They read the agreement into the record. However, the agreement didn't reflect the proposed judgment decree did not reflect that agreement. And that's the reason we're here, is to get an agreement get a judgment decree that is reflective of their agreement. Okay, pursuant to Minnesota Rule of General Practice 307B, opposing counsel, respondent's attorney submitted the proposed judgment and decree that would give her client a windfall of about $163,000 and change, more than what my client, the appellant, Mark Sandberg, would receive. Also, Mr. Sandberg, the appellant, submitted an affidavit and a letter objecting to the entry of respondent's proposed judgment and decree. The trial court eventually entered that judgment and decree that was proposed by the respondent over appellant's objections. And a respondent was awarded $548,467, and appellant was awarded $421,402. That's where the difference of the 163 comes in. Again, this is not including the assets that were already divided equally, where they said, we'll just split up this account. So we just took the assets that, when I added those numbers and I put them in my appellant brief, I reflected that. It's not including the assets that were already divided equally, because they would still be equal. That was contrary to the party's agreement to divide their mental state equally. And again, the purpose of this appeal is to correct the errors by the trial court in entering
response. So, counsel, I need to just stop you with a threshold question, because you've repeated a couple of times your basic premise, which is really well laid out in your brief, that this is a claim on your part to seek an equal division according to the party's stipulation. And I understand that theory. What I'm struggling with is what exactly the question is that's in front of this court. I'm sure you're familiar with the Shirk case, decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court. The language in that case is pretty emphatic. It says that, because you're clearly asking us to reverse the district court's judgment and decree and send this back so that, as you said, you know, your theory, you can get an equal division of this marital property. But the Shirk case says that when a judgment and decree is entered based upon a stipulation, the Supreme Court held that the stipulation is merged into the judgment, and the decree and stipulation cannot thereafter be a target of attack by a party seeking relief unless, you know, their sole relief is a motion that meets the requirements of 518.145 subdivision 2. And I know you're, you know, familiar with, of course, all the options available in this type of case, but you did not file a 518.145 motion.
Your Honor, I am familiar with Shirk. This case does not implicate Shirk. There is no stipulation.
You need to help me with that, because you do rely on Clark, and Clark clearly recognizes the implications of Shirk. So I don't understand your reasoning in your brief as to why Shirk doesn't apply.
Because Shirk is based on a stipulation. And then once it merges into the judgment decree, then you have the 518.145, which is the equivalent of Rule 60.02 in the civil procedure rules. And you have to show a mistake, neglect, inadvertence, fraud, misrepresentation. Here, we're proceeding under Rule 307B and then the Clark and the Tuffhill cases. We are not.
But if I look only at the Clark case and I look at the 307 review that happened in that case, it's very procedurally oriented. Did the district court abuse its discretion in the way in which it conducted the 307 review? Well, and that's not your argument either, counsel. I mean, not you're not asking us to find any procedural error by the district court under Rule 307. You're actually asking us to test the judgment and decree against your view of the party's stipulation. And well, I just don't see where that's in front of us in light of Shirk. I mean, the Supreme Court was pretty emphatic with this court and our review in Shirk and said we had handled it improperly. So how can we ignore Shirk here?
Well, but there is no stipulation. My client didn't sign a stipulation. A stipulation is something that's actually signed by the parties and is submitted to the court, and then it becomes the judgment decree. And then you attack it.
What was put on the record when they had been meeting with Mr. Tuff? And as I read the transcript, it sounds like everyone agreed to what that was.
Correct. However, when they submitted the judgment decree, it didn't conform to what the party's agreement. It's not a matter of what I say it is. It's not a matter of what my opinion is. It's what the opposing counsel even represented to the court. She said specifically that it was to effectuate an even division of the assets. And what she submitted to the court did not effectuate an even division. It wasn't even close. It was $163,000 in her client's favor. And when you see in my first brief, I laid that out. In their response, they don't even address it. They don't even challenge it. They don't dispute that it was intended to be an even division. And they don't dispute that her client received $163,000 windfall. They don't say that anywhere in their brief. They don't even touch on it. They dance around on other issues, but I don't see this as being implicating Shirk from a procedural standpoint. But Clark and Tuffhill both specifically point out language in their cases that you can't, under Rule 307B, you can't force feed something to an opposing side who hadn't agreed to it. They say that you cannot buy, this is Clark, you can't by judicial fiat impose conditions upon the parties to which they did not stipulate and deprive them of their day in court. It also says the trial court errs when it enters a proposed judgment that contains terms to which the parties did not stipulate. And then also the other case, Tuffhill, cites that if the court, the trial court doesn't accept the stipulation, the party should not, absent unusual circumstances, be precluded from litigating their claims. And also goes on to say a judgment should not be allowed to stand unless there is a meeting of the minds and the essential terms of the agreement.
So counsel, if I go to that level with you, so if I'm looking at your argument under Clark and I recognize that you're certainly quoting the case correctly. There's no judicial fiat allowed under Rule 307. But the district court did review your objection, your client's objection to the proposed judgment and decree, and the district court recognized what you're just saying now, which is that it isn't mathematically equal, right? The judge definitely recognized that, saw the $75,000 difference, but the district court went on and said, and I'm reading from the addendum at 18, so that the proposed judgment and decree conforms to the party's agreement placed on the record after their moderated settlement conference. And then the judge recites the statutory standard. It is fair and equitable under the circumstances. So I'm just struggling to see where you have identified error by the district court, because the district court did find that the final judgment and decree did conform to the party stipulation. You cherry pick some comments from the hearing where the stipulations entered into the record, but the district court reviewed the hearing as a whole and found that the judgment and decree did conform. So there's no judicial fiat here that I can see.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the end language in the court, it's clear that the court didn't do the math. My client was asking the court to do the math. And more importantly, I understand what you say about cherry picking, but the concept of equality in the division of the marital property was throughout the transcript. And it's also in Exhibit 1, which is Addendum 25 through 27. It has multiple references of the equality that the parties were achieving, which is on Addendum 26, which says that they were going to divide their retirement assets exactly 50-50, $443,922 each. Similarly, on the last page, Addendum 27, they talk about a difference to equalize. That is a phrase. When you have an equalizer in a divorce case, that means you are dividing it equally. It means one person maybe gets, maybe a 100,000 more than the other, and they have to pay the other party 50,000 to make it exactly equal. That's what the parties agreed to here. That's what my client agreed to. That's what he thought he was getting. The judgment decree clearly does not give that. And that regardless of what the judge put in the end in his little memorandum at the end, he's wrong. It is not what the parties agreed to. And more importantly, when he says that he says in the last sentence, it's almost axiomatic under Minnesota law, an equitable division of marital assets is not a perfectly equal division. Well, that's if you were litigating the case. He could make that decision. He would have that discretion to do that. But when the parties have reached an agreement to get that mathematical equality, then the result needs to be that. It needs to be what the parties agree to.
Counsel, if I can, I do appreciate that your argument certainly has a lot of record involved, and your analysis of why the judgment is unequal and therefore not consistent with the stipulation does touch on a number of things. And so I'd like it if you would highlight for me, just so it's your first issue in your appellate brief, I'm not exactly sure I follow which specific errors you are saying the judge made in entry of the judgment and decree, in which ways the judgment and decree doesn't match the party's stipulation.
Okay.
I definitely follow you on 2, 3, and 4. I struggled on number one. I am not sure what you're referring to.
Well, let me refer to the three points that I was trying to get at in my brief, which is number one, the court took the $93,000 that was to come from the 401k to pay off the HELOC, which is on the cabin, the home equity line of credit. That came specifically from my client's share of the 401k, not off the top. And that was the agreement. It came from the 401k. When you do that, then you divide the assets up equally. And then you take $93,000 from my client's asset rather than off the top. So that by itself creates a massive disparity. In addition, the court reflects the marital balance of the cabin as $28,000 and change. It's supposed to be $100,000 because they know the HELOC is going to get paid off from the 401k. So those two combined.
Counsel, I want to ask you about the cabin. The cabin is non-marital property according to the district court's findings and according to the attachments to the judgment and decree, so the title.
Okay, actually, all but $100,000 is non-marital. The parties do not dispute. $100,000 of it is
so
marital.
Explain that to me. There were $100,000 in improvements to the cabin, and those were jointly made by the parties. Is that what you mean when you say $100,000?
Okay, I need some clarification too. Yeah. What I understood the cabin by agreement, by stipulation, was valued at $100,000. I don't know where you got that figure, but now it sounds like you're arguing that the cabin is actually worth more.
I don't know. I wasn't the lawyer on the case in the trial court, but I can tell you the record clearly reflects in the judgment decree itself and in the parties' agreements that it is the marital value, and it says so on the Exhibit 1 on page ADD 25. The cabin could be worth $300,000, whatever it is. $100,000 of it is marital. The rest is non-marital. We're not challenging that. But the $100,000 is marital, and I don't believe that's even disputed by either of the sides. But when you take the $100,000 and you subtract the $70,000 for the debt, when you know that it's coming from the 401k, it undervalues that. In addition,
so counsel, my reading of the discussion at the hearing where the stipulation was placed on the record is a little different, and that's that the HELOC was a joint marital debt that the parties agreed to pay off before the division of marital and not, and this in the case of the cabin, non-marital property, and that the cabin was seen as non-marital property that had been encumbered by a marital debt. And if I'm wrong about that, let me know. But that's how I read the transcript. Maybe there's something in the transcript that I missed.
So I don't know. I would have to review the transcript on the specific aspect of that. But on Exhibit 1, it clearly says it's the allocation of marital property. $100,000 is checked in the box, or is in the box for the cabin for the wife. It's allocation of marital property. The non-marital property, the non-marital component of that, goes to the wife and remains the wife's. I don't believe there's any dispute on that issue, and I'm glad you raised the issue so we could clarify it. But the property is clearly $100,000 marital, and the rest would be non-marital. It looks like my time is up, unless the court has further questions.
Thank you.
And Mr. Schiff, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. Michelle Canise for Vicki Sandberg, the petitioner and respondent in this appeal. The parties entered into divorce proceedings in December of 2018. Subsequent to that, they engaged in quite a bit of ADR, alternative dispute resolution, specifically two financial early neutral evaluation sessions occurred, one June of 2019 and one occurred in October of 2019. With Mr. Tuft. The parties then went into a moderated settlement conference with Mr. Tuft to again discuss settlement of financial issues. This occurred in early 2020. The parties read their agreement into the record, as the court knows, and agreed to be bound by it. The parties were asked if they understood it and if they thought it was fair and if they agreed to it. The parties agreed that this division of property would be subject to some adjustments that would occur off the record. And so those adjustments did occur. The parties were unable to reach a written stipulation following the moderated settlement conference. And so after some time passed, referee Hutchinson, who
if I could ask just one clarifying question, you referenced sure. adjustments made off the record, and that is, I agree with you, it's clearly referenced in the where the stipulation is placed on the record. But my read of those comments are that they have to do with the outstanding debts that the parties agreed would be paid first before the division of property, and that the comments were related to updating the amount of the debt. Apparently there's some ongoing use of credit is all I could figure. You may know more than I do about that, but ongoing use of credit by both parties during this time period. And so the goal was to update the loan amount, not to otherwise make adjustments off the record, was it? I mean, that would be suggest that the stipulation wasn't very final.
I can speak to that. I actually was an attorney at the district court level and was a part of this. The parties did agree that they were going to update balances on the liabilities that were going to be paid first. And in fact, I don't have a specific reference to the transcript, but there is reference to the parties saying any debts that are out there are going to be paid off and taken off the balance sheet. And then, of course, the parties discussed paying off the HELOC with the 401k, and that's also in the transcript. As it relates to the house value that was referenced,
I guess what I'm looking for from you, Ms. Canese, is after the stipulation was put on the record, were the parties intending to make other adjustments or only to update the amount of the debt or the liabilities as you described them?
Only to update the amount of the liabilities.
And I think, is it Section 8 of Exhibit 1? I mean, they made a specific reference on the record, I think, to the portion of Exhibit 1 that would be updated. I think that's what I...
Correct. Yeah. And it was in Exhibit 1, yes, Section 8. So it's the liabilities section. And in fact, there is references in the transcript to if there's other debts that go into that section, the intent is to pay that all off and take it off the balance sheet. the parties did agree to the value of the cabin property. And there's reference in the transcript as well as in the judgment and decree that the marital value is that $28,970. That is, the parties agreed that the cabin is non-marital and it was encumbered by a marital HELOC.
So counsel, if you'd look at exhibit one, which, you know, was made an exhibit to the final judgment and decree, I believe, and it's included in the addendum at 25, I think the argument that Mr. Schiff is making has to do with where the $100,000 is placed. I mean, I honestly find it confusing because exhibit one says the cabin has a total value of $100,000, and then it says the allocation of marital, presumably property, to the wife is $100,000. So, and yet it also has a box check saying this is non-marital for the wife. So what is it? So
certainly. And I think the way it's written on exhibit one, I could see where it would be somewhat confusing. I don't think it confused the parties based upon the extensive discussions they had and the many times they were in front of referee Hutchinson discussing this issue. The parties chose $100,000 as the value of the property. They agreed that it's non-marital. They agreed that the $71,030 that encumbered the property was marital debt. And they further agreed that the marital value of the property was $28,970. So if it's reflected somewhat confusingly on exhibit one for an outside observer to these parties who extensively went through this exhibit, it was not.
So you're suggesting, if I'm following you right, then that when I look at exhibit one and I see $100,000 allocated to the wife as marital property across from the cabin, that's actually a mistake because she gets $100,000 in value, but it's not non-marital. Is that
correct?
What
$100,000 is non-marital.
All right, but there's this $28,000, and that's in the judgment decree that is deemed to be marital. And I assume those are maybe improvements to the cabin.
If my memory serves, the parties had purchased vehicles with the HELOC and just took the non-marital equity in the cabin as security. So they took a HELOC against that and then bought vehicles.
So I don't understand then. What's the marital equity? Where does the $28,000 come from?
That's what the parties agreed to the value of the cabin as the non-marital value to effectuate the marital equity that they netted out. It was part of their negotiations. The cabin was never appraised. They just agreed that they were going to have a marital net equity in the cabin value of $28,970.
So could you respond to Mr. Schiff's argument that SHRC and 518 don't apply here?
Certainly. I think they should apply to a situation such as this because there should have been a motion to vacate or be relieved from judgment under 518.145. I agree that was not done here, and I think that's fatal to this appeal. The appellant did appeal the court's decision on the Rule 307B objections, but can't cite to what error the court committed. And that's largely the thrust of my argument here is what did the court do wrong? That is what this court is impaneled to decide. It's an error correcting court. It's not a court that's here to impose its own judgment upon how the district court resolved this case. This court is here to decide what did it do wrong? Did the district court abuse its discretion? And the court was not asked to decide whether it should reopen the judgment or relieve a party from the stipulation because no motion was brought pursuant to 518.145. And I think that would have been the proper way to seek relief in this matter. However, appellant did not do that. And so there is no relief to be found under SHRC and 518.145 because it was never raised at the district court level. There's similarly no relief to be found under Rule 307 because appellant cannot cite to any procedural rule or technicality or anything that the district court did wrong in deciding whether to enter a judgment based upon the transcript while considering objections made and considering a proposed judgment decree. The Clark case, I think, is the one that comes closest to discussing what needs to happen to uphold a court's judgment on such a request under Rule 307. And in that case, because the court considered a transcript, even though it was after the fact, after the judgment was entered, and because the court made note that it considered the objections, that was enough for the appellate court to say that the district court did not abuse its discretion.
Ms. Kanese, if we agree with you and determine that we are bound by Shirk, my question is, do we also have an obligation to review the district court's order of conduct attorney's fees, conduct-based attorney's fees?
I do not believe so. The conduct-based attorney's fee request, similarly, I think, was not properly brought before the district court. I think if the appellant made a motion to be relieved from a stipulation and reopen it, I think all issues would be reopened, including the court's granting of attorney's fees. But that motion was not brought, and so I think the entire judgment is foreclosed. The appellant could have also...
So was there a judgment entered on the attorney's fee award?
There was. I believe it was for $999. Right. And there was an ongoing request for that in the proceedings. I believe it's Rule of General Practice 119 that governs those requests in family court proceedings. And so long as the request is for less than $1,000, it can just be made by motion and without any sort of support.
It's not anywhere contemplated that that was part of a stipulation, which ended right. up being in a judgment and decree. So that's why I'm wondering how you can argue that the award of attorney's fees wouldn't also be considered by this court, why it should not be considered, and on what basis then we would consider it.
Well, I think there's two issues here. First, the stipulation, if it were challenged properly at the district court level to preserve it for appeal and consideration at the court of appeals level, that motion could have been brought before the judgment was entered. It could have been brought after the hearing, the agreement was placed on the record. So I feel like that is one issue. Another issue is then this attorney fee issue. And I still think it's before the court because it's in the appellant's brief, but there's no error again cited by the district court. So, you know, there's no allegation that the district court abused its discretion procedurally or in deciding that conduct-based attorney's fees were appropriate here. And so, you know, I think the appellant could have perhaps brought a motion for amended findings or otherwise sought relief from the district court first before appealing that issue. Even if that attorney's fee issue is properly before this court, there's no error assigned. And so I think that's fatal to their appeal on that issue, is what did the district court do wrong? And I think that's the fatal flaw in all of the requests for relief that appellant brings to this court. What did the district court do wrong? The district court did what it was asked, and it followed the rules and it followed procedure. And the only thing that I see here is that appellant's just displeased with the outcome. That's not something that this court is designed to address, is dissatisfaction with an outcome. The proceedings, I think, were intact. They were by the book, and they complied with the law. And I don't see anywhere where the district court abused its discretion in any of its decisions. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Schiff.
Yes, Your Honor. I did have a chance to quickly look at the Clark case. It actually gives you two options to attack the judgment in this case. One is you can attack the stipulation itself, or and you can seek to withdraw or vacate the stipulation, or you can attack, the party can attack the proposed judgment, alleging that the proposed judgment does not accurately reflect the party's stipulation. That's what Clark says. It gives you two options. We chose
to counsel, I just have to stop you for a moment, because when Clark lays out those two options, it says before entry of the judgment, right? It's pretty clear that those two options are available to you prior, I'm quoting it now from page 463, prior to the time judgment is entered on an oral stipulation. That time has passed. We are past that time.
Okay, well, I don't see that as being fatal to our argument. We've already brought our arguments to the court. We've already objected to it. And he entered the judgment over my client's objections. So we disagree that there's any procedural flaw in this appeal that prohibits us. We are attacking the judgment itself. And with respect to counsel's references to extensive discussions off the record, we cited in our reply brief, that can't even be considered by this Court of Appeals. And she doesn't cite anything. She's not testifying here. She's attempting to explain certain things. But getting back to that, with the marital equity, because she was trying to testify how there were things that were, it might have been confusing. Well, the decree itself identifies that it's a marital $100,000 asset, and it is a marital $70,000 loan against it. That's how you get to $28,000 of marital equity. You take those two numbers. For her to say that Exhibit 1 was a mistake, that's not borne out by anything in the record. That's her statement for the very first time in this oral argument. And also, it's my understanding that there was a cabin that was built on the property. That's where the $100,000 marital equity came in. I believe in the record, and I don't have it in front of me, that the record would show that the cabin's worth more than $100,000. But the $100,000 is the marital equity, and the debt against it is the marital debt. That's how you get to the net marital equity value. With respect to one of the things I want to address, it's kind of a policy matter. If the court upholds this decision, then as a matter of practice, people will cite to this, and people, the attorney who is the one submitting the decree will always have an incentive to submit something that benefits his client that's not what's agreed to, and take a shot. Maybe the court will agree to it. And that's what happened here. This judge gave the other side $163,000 more than my client received, and that is not equitable. That is not what they agreed to. That is contrary to their agreement. And they'll be able to cite to this case with that authority. That I don't believe that's what the law allows, and I don't believe that's what Clark allows. Clark allows us to challenge that because the decision was directly contrary to what they agreed to. And again, opposing counsel didn't even respond in her argument just now, disputing they agreed to an equal division of the property, or that the division of property is $163,000 more in her client's favor. She's had two opportunities, once in her brief and once just now, and she didn't challenge those two items. That's why we're saying that there's clear error. As to the attorney's fees, again, it's a small issue, and same thing with the debt. My client didn't agree to pay the extra $4,700 of the opposing party's non-marital debt on her joint or on her separate her Sandberg Consulting Visa credit card. My client didn't agree to that as well. That's why we're asking this court to reverse it, remand with instructions to enter the judgment that is consistent with the party's agreement to effectuate the equal division that even opposing counsel represented to the court in the court in the transcript. And at a minimum, send it back so we can have my client's day in court, which is what was contemplated in the Clark case and what is contemplated in the Tufthill case as well. I will be, let's see if I have any further comments. If your honors have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. The case was well briefed and well argued, and we will get our decision out within the statutory timeframe. Thank you for your arguments.
Thank you.